From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Netflix came first, shifting from DVDs to streaming video. Amazon pivoted from the everything store to the just about everything video store. Now come Disney, Apple, AT&T. They're all corporate superpowers, each with an iconic brand. Yet they're entering deceivingly unfamiliar and competitive terrain. This is beyond getting you to cut your cable cords. It's a fight for your eyes, your loyalty, your time, and your wallet. And it's a reasonable thing to ask, what will we get in exchange? And can we get it without losing our shirts and our minds? This hour on Point, the world of streaming entertainment and the future of TV. Join us. What path are you charting in these new waters to figure out what services you'll subscribe to and which you'll ditch? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington, D.C. is Sarah Fisher. She's media reporter for Axios. She has reported extensively on the streaming media and entertainment landscape. Sarah, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
I want to set the scene a little bit with a clip or two, and then we can kind of take it from there. The media mogul Barry Diller, one of the most influential figures in shaping the modern entertainment terrain. Among his past positions are chairman of Paramount Pictures, chairman of 20th Century Fox. Diller argues the success of Netflix and Amazon has forced his former Hollywood rivals to engage in the streaming wars on undesirable terms. Here he spoke with CNBC in July.
So now you have an arms race. Never existed before. You have a complete blurring of television and movies, which has only happened in the last couple of years. You have these two new entrants, which have forced not only consolidation on the old players, but forced them to now make investments in their wildest dreams they've never had to make before. And so you have Disney, which has mobilized itself like a true, you know, God knows, super force, wanting to compete in streaming because of these two big players of Amazon and Netflix.
And sir, I want to play a brief clip. He's invoked Disney. Disney has maintained a dominant presence on TV thanks to ABC and especially thanks to not just the Disney networks, but the ESPN networks. Yet Disney chairman and CEO Bob Iger has relentlessly pushed this drive to culminate in this month's streaming Disney Plus service, citing the continuing momentum away from traditional TV viewing patterns. Here he spoke with CNN in May.
You're going to see a lot of change in media due to technological disruption. And that will create change in consumer behavior. And I think it's likely that direct-to-consumer, over-the-top platforms that are focused more on program consumption versus channel consumption are likely to grow significantly over time.
Right.
And I think you're going to see consolidation on the linear channel front.
So, Sarah Fisher, you cover all this. This feels very much to me like the fight scene in Anchorman, you know, where all the local TV news crews comes in, PBS comes in at the end. It's just a madcap. Their limbs getting hacked off. What are we seeing play out in front of our eyes?
Well, for one, there's a huge tension here. You have all of these companies that have traditional linear TV businesses. They have networks.
Let's be clear for our listeners. Linear means what?
It's a network that belongs on cable or satellite. It's a package that you pay monthly. Usually it's around $100. And it means you're not getting TV through the internet. You're getting the TV through a satellite signal or through cable. And so you have these companies who recognize that that kind of TV is dying. People are cutting the cord. They're opting for cheaper digital packages, or maybe they don't even want live TV at all. Maybe they're just buying Netflix. And so they need to create a product that will meet the 21st century consumer, something digital, something fast, something on demand. But at the same time, they can't let it cannibalize their traditional business. That's still where they make most of their money. And so companies like Disney have a real problem. They need to create something new, but don't create it too fast. Don't let it eat your existing business.
So I'm looking at a list in front of me. There's Netflix, you know, which obviously still has a minor business in DVDs, but basically, you know, several streaming plans, starts as low as $9 a month and tops out at $16 a month. You've got Amazon Prime, very popular because it's $120 a year or $13 a month, but you get free deliveries from Amazon, so it's a pretty good package. Disney Plus, Bob Iger's outfit, is now offering $7 a month for, you know, almost its entire back catalog, and we can break that down a little bit. HBO Max is going to come forward for $15 a month, which I think is what I pay for HBO on its own as a streaming service. You got Peacock. Now, Peacock is the symbol we think of for NBC. It's a combination of NBC's catalog and or a lot of it and Universal Pictures catalog, and that's going to be ad supporting. And you've got these other ones like Hulu, which has been out there for a bit. We can talk about Quibi later on. But there are a lot of things. How are consumers supposed to say yes, this, not that, or yes to all of the above, and I'm okay paying, you know, three, four, five different outfits, you know, over $100 a year?
That was such a good rundown. And yeah, there's a ton of options out there for consumers. Here's how I like to bucket it. You have options that are subscription-based, which means you have to pay a monthly fee, typically between $5 and $15. And then you have options that are totally free, and they're supported by advertising. I think consumers are going to want to do a mix of both. I think consumers will sit through ads if it means they don't have to pay something monthly for the content. Peacock is supposedly going to be all ad-based and all free. So you can do an option like that and at the same time pay your, you know, $12, $15 a month for Netflix. The other thing, too, is a lot of researchers are starting to look at this and they're saying, hey, is this really going to be cheaper for consumers? If you're paying about $100 a month for cable, but you subscribe to, I don't know, five or six streaming services, that might end up being the same cost. And what they found is this. The average American household, which, by the way, brings in around $46,000 average household income, is going to pay around $45 a month on streaming services. And so it's up to them to determine how they're going to divvy up that money. Do they put all of their money into a live service to get things like news and sports? Do they put all of their money into entertainment and get three things like a Netflix and a Disney Plus? I think it really just depends on the need of that household.
And Sarah, can I just be nitpicky? You said that the average American household, you said about $46,000 a year and is likely to spend, call it $45, $46 on streaming services. Is that in addition to cable, or is that $46 standing in for kind of all your video, you know, consumption?
Right now, it's in addition to cable because 75% of U.S. households still do subscribe to some sort of pay TV. I imagine as more people migrate off of cable, that that number will be higher because they're not going to be paying an additional premium for cable. But for now, you know, some people still want to get a cable bundle where there's live sports and all that. And then they still want to get entertainment bundles, or they still want to get a sports streaming service. Think about something like ESPN Plus or DAZN on top of their live cable.
Well, to give listeners a sense of this, my day job, I cover media too. Sarah drills down a lot of the economics on this in ways even beyond what I do. But if you think about ESPN, which Disney owns 80% of, I think, in a partnership with Hearst, you know, the average deal it has with cable providers and satellite providers is that they have to, ESPN is such a foundational thing for a hardcore viewers of the channel, of this ESPN family of channels, that I think they pay something like $8 a month. Well, for the right to Disney and to its co-owners for the right to broadcast ESPN on its service. So if you multiply $8 by 75 million or maybe 80 million American households, if there are 110 TV households in the country, you know, 80 times $8 is a lot of money every month. You know, that's billions of dollars a year before, many billions of dollars a year in revenue before they've sold a single ad on ESPN or ESPN2 or those other ones that are additional fees are paid for. So this is a lot of money. And yet if they offer the streaming service, what is the fear for somebody like Bob Iger that Disney will be cannibalizing that model, which has won them so much in profits over the years?
It's a huge fear, and it's a delicate dance. Right now, what Disney is doing is they're withholding all of the major sports rights to their live cable channel. They want to make sure that Monday Night Football is available exclusively on live TV. And that's because, as you mentioned, they're making a ton of money off of it. So they can't afford to have people not buy cable packages because they can get Monday Night Football on streaming. However, you do need to offer consumers enough good programming on the ESPN Plus streaming platform to get them to start migrating into Disney's streaming ecosystem. What they're doing now is they're doing a combination. They're doing their biggest flagship stuff, Monday Night Football, some stuff with MLB, and they're keeping it on their live linear channel. But then they'll do some less popular games. They'll do some, quite frankly, less popular sports and put them on streaming. And they're hoping to just continue this delicate balance until one day the scales tip and Roger Goodell and other sports commissioners say, you know what? We want to put all of our stuff on streaming. I think that's still a little while to go. I think streaming has to prove that it's not going to have any technological issues before they can totally win sports rights away from cable. But until then, networks like ESPN, as you mentioned, that makes so much money off of cable, they have to do this little delicate dance.
We've only got a couple minutes before our first brief break, but Sarah Fisher, you know, one of the things that's amazing to me is the existence of Hulu, which was done by a consortium of major broadcast networks as a way of saying, all right, we're going to do some sort of rearguard action so we're not eaten alive by Netflix. And this was really before Amazon was a big player in this. It was owned by Disney, Fox, and Comcast, which is not only a powerhouse in telecommunications but also the parent company of NBC. But that Disney bought out much of Fox's entertainment holdings. That means Disney owns 67, you know, two-thirds of this. NBC, Comcast owns a third of this, and yet each of them, Disney has Disney Plus, and NBC, Comcast is intending to launch Peacock. How does that play out?
Yes, and it's worth noting that within the next 5 years, Disney will take Comcast's share. So Disney is expected to be the 100% full owner of Hulu in the near future. I think what Disney needs to focus on is how it's going to take Hulu and differentiate it from Disney Plus. Right now, Disney Plus is considered family-friendly. You have Kevin Mayer, who's the head of Disney's streaming service, who said Monday that they're trying to market it and make sure that adults still get into it with programming like The Mandalorian. But it doesn't really include edgy content. It's not going to include adult cartoons. It's not going to include some of adult sitcoms.
And so, FX.
Exactly. They're trying to figure out a way to make one more family-friendly and one more adult-friendly.
We're discussing the streaming wars and how they're changing television. You've been hearing there the voice of Sarah Fisher. She worked as a media reporter for Axios, also the Dr. Phil. For those of us trying to think through all these streaming issues, join our conversation. How do you hunt and gather for what you want in television and movies? Are you on board with Disney Plus or holding out for HBO Max? I'm David Folkenflik, and you're listening to On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the rise in streaming entertainment services. Many advocates argue it's ushered in a golden age in television. Is The Irishman inspired at 3.5 hours or just bloated? You have Netflix to thank for that, either way. Disney's coming out with TV shows based on Star Wars prequels. Apple's spending billions of dollars to catch up. And a lot of older Hollywood powers are hoping not to be left in the dust. You can join our conversation. What do you notice that's different about the video you consume or the nature of the shows that draw your attention? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me this hour is Sarah Fisher. She's media reporter for Axios. Joining us now from Los Angeles, California, Howard Owens. He's founder and co-CEO of Propagate. That's an independent production company that has created shows for Netflix, Apple, and Amazon. He has previously served as president of the National Geographic Channels. Howard Owens, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I also understand, Howard, that we have you at least in significant part to thank for bringing The Office across the pond to American audiences from the UK. So if that's true, thank you for that.
It was my partner, Ben Silverman, but I was there when he did it, and it was exciting, and you're welcome.
Present at the launch. Howard, I want to take a couple calls and then get your feedback on what they have to say and also on some of these issues we're walking through today. Let's go first to Austin, Texas. We've got David on the line listening. Weigh in here, David.
Hi, guys. David, this is your subject matter of expertise, so I wanted to just get in a survey of what you think is keeping cord cutters that are young from cutting the cord. I would argue that it's news and sports because they kind of have a social tether to our attendance, but drama, humor, and to a certain extent, education don't, and that stuff you can time shift. so that can move to a streaming format.
Well, David, thanks for the call.
What does that say about our value of education?
Well, hold on that. What does what say about our value of education? You think that, our education system is
implicated? Sorry about that. These topics of like learning, I've noticed that the History Channel and the Learning Channel, their programming is turning to just kind of fast food consumption. It's not any education content at all. It's conspiratorial. It's weird content, if anything, other than, I guess you would call it reality TV.
Uh-huh. Okay, David, I appreciate that. I'm going to throw that to my guests. I want to start with you, Howard. You know, I have noticed over the years, you know, Bravo and A&E channels started as really higher culture channels, and there was Ovation. The History Channel really was a little bit more steeped in exploring history. I'm really interested in World War II, but it seemed at a certain point become the World War II and Hitler Channel. Some of these things seem to me to predate streaming itself. Let's take the heart of his question, David's question, though, Howard Owens, and focus a little bit on, you know, what is preventing people or impelling people to stick with cable things, and how has that tension maybe changed what we're seeing on more linear conventional television, as Sarah defined it earlier?
I think there are programs on broadcast TV and on cable, and there are viewing habits. People have grown up. And so, you know, it's mostly older people that continue to watch, you know, broadcast and cable and more traditional TV. But the programmers there also put a big effort into their originality and their, you know, and I think the kind of difference that you get on cable and television is you get weekly series. They become more, they have an opportunity to become more part of culture. If you look at things like The Voice or American Idol, if you look at, you know, what the Discovery and History Channel have done, they tend to create event programming. As a matter of fact, at Discovery and History, they do a lot of live events. So they're looking to become part of the cultural conversation. They still program during, you know, weekly new, you know, new daily newspapers and things like that. And I think it's the divide is one that, you know, we have a la carte programming, and there has been a little bit of an educational, I think, divide. The more sophisticated you are, the more money you have, the quicker that you launched into streaming, the quicker you knew how to download the apps and knew had the money to do that. And so I think there's a little bit of a culture clash to the programming wars. But I still think, you know, to what your the caller said before, I think the people that are making television for cable and for broadcast, I think those people have ambition to create good, smart, fun TV. They didn't jump in the business to try to do a lowest common denominator or chase the bottom or anything like that. I think viewers' tastes in America are pretty raw, and that the American viewer likes edgy, grab you by the gut content. And you know, it's a business. You know, those cable companies and those net, you know, they're there to make money, and they, you know, as much as they would like to put on, you know, the Pavarotti concert and hope that they get a great viewing, live PD tends to draw more viewers for the arts and entertainment, for the old arts and entertainment network, A&E.
And when you say live, do you mean reality show stuff, or you're talking about concerts and things like that?
Oh no, I was just saying live PD is one of the biggest shows on cable. It's a live weekly show that it's on A&E Network, and they, you know, show. Sorry.
I mean, don't apologize at all, but the crazy thing is I cover media and people assume I see everything out there. There are so many channels and services, it's impossible. You know, it's just impossible to keep up.
That's a big cable phenomenon.
Yeah, right. And you notice it, because when you pay that much money for cable, you're like, is the fact that there's so much that I'm not consuming somehow devaluing how much I'm paying for all that they're offering? There are one or two folks who are calling in. I do want to take their calls and add them to the conversation as well. From Bowling Green, Kentucky, not site of any massacre, thankfully. Gary, thanks for calling in. Tell me what your thoughts are and what your experience is in thinking about all the opportunities that people have for consuming TV and video content.
Well, my father started our family business, TV Repair, back in 1954 when he came back from the Korean War. And he's 90 years old now. And what we have had, we've come full circle. As of yesterday afternoon, I have installed over 441 antennas. This has been about 2 years. And basically, it started with the double rate increases from the satellite providers later when our Spectrum and Insight did their dance about a takeover, so forth. Rates have just really escalated. As far as the streaming goes, that's the big tipping point right there. People are maintaining an affordable internet provider, and they're signing up for Hulu, YouTube TV, and Sling. And that's what I'm suggesting they do, because a lot of people this time of year, their contracts with cable companies, so forth, satellite, their bills are actually tripling. I had one the other day. The bill was over $190 for like 50 channels. So
that's crazy.
In fact, I told the lady who picked up on just a minute ago, the last one I did, we made some improvements on his current antenna system to high definition. And he went from 6 channels to 64 channels here in South Central Kentucky.
And Gary, I just want to be clear. You said 441 antennas, and those are so people can still watch local channels on a digital antennas while turning over most of their content to the streamers rather than the cable giants.
Oh, absolutely. That seems to be the biggest thing. I know the question about ESPN and Monday Night Football, the Fox Local that we have here broadcast, they've shown every game and such. And I think they do need to turn that around, including Monday Night Football as well, and not just isolated on one satellite or cable network like that.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Gary. I do want to turn now, you know, one of the big players is a player that we don't think of as an entertainment company because it hasn't been an entertainment company. Let's think about Apple. Here is a clip of the introduction of its streaming service November 1st, along with the highly anticipated original program, The Morning Show. It starred Jennifer Aniston, Reese Witherspoon, Steve Carell. Here's Apple's CEO, Tim Cook, in March, unveiling the plans for the company's streaming subscription service.
Great stories can move us and inspire us. They can surprise us and challenge our assumptions. We feel we can contribute something important to our culture and to society through great storytelling. So we partnered with the most thoughtful, accomplished, and award-winning group of creative visionaries who have ever come together in one place to create a new service unlike anything that's been done before. Apple TV Plus.
Sarah Fisher, is Apple Plus unlike anything that's ever been done before?
Well, it's a little bit different. First of all, it's small. I mean, you have all of these streaming services that are coming out with bloated programming offers, Netflix and Amazon Prime, and Apple is not trying to license content. All Apple TV Plus is original content. So from that perspective, it is kind of unique. It's a little bit more like a network than it is an aggregator. But the thing I would say about Apple TV Plus, and it's very similar in my opinion to Amazon Prime Video, is Apple's not trying to become a video giant. Apple is trying to sell phones. And video is something for them that's going to help them sell phones. It's going to help bring people into a larger ecosystem of hardware, just as Amazon Prime Video helps Amazon sell Prime subscriptions, or eventually HBO Max is going to help AT&T sell wireless subscriptions.
And both Amazon and Apple are perfectly happy to sell you, rent or buy, sell you outright the ability to stream various video content. That is, rather than Netflix, which just has a flat fee and says, here you go. Howard Owens, I wanted to play another clip from Apple's first original series. This was before Apple Plus was done. This is Planet of the Apps, a 2017 reality show pitting app developers against each other. It starred Gwyneth Paltrow, Jessica Alba, and Will.i.am. The program created by Propagate, production film of the very same guest, Howard Owens. Here's a snippet from the trailer.
When he really honed in on what actually excites him, it opened up this whole world of possibilities.
Just because we like it doesn't mean the investor likes it. I truly believe in this, but it's up to the fate of the investor.
We would love to work with you.
Let's do this.
I'm telling you right now, they are not going to love that.
It just gives me headaches.
I think what you're doing is quite impressive.
Howard, in the pacing and the selection of celebrity hosts, in the kind of the rhetoric that we're hearing there. This sounds very much as though it could be. It wasn't, but it could be a reality contest show on any of a number of established channels. Apple is now finally launched. You guys do stuff at Propagate for a variety of different streaming outfits. Is there a clear sense or sensibility in pitching a show or a project to each one? That is there a way in which in your mind you're already disambiguating, well, these are the guys who are going to enjoy, you know, shows with incredibly complex leading characters, or these are the ones, you know, how do you differentiate in your own minds what space these new players are operating in?
It's a lot of market research and a lot of relation. And you know, I use that term. It's a lot of relationship. It's calling the buyers and speaking to the agents, talking to the people. You know, we've had series with all of the streamers, and so we have relationships there. But they're finding their own DNA. I mean, I think Netflix feels at most to me like a broadcast kind of network. They want to be – they kind of are all things to everyone. They were first to their race. You know, they kind of have my favorite shows. You know, when I'm waiting for – you know, the Crown came out on Sunday. My wife and I were very excited and have been staying up late this week trying to catch up, you know. So, but we also watch shows on Hulu. We watch shows on Amazon. My wife, you know, last week when Apple launched, you know, she's checking out the morning show and so excited to see Reese and Jennifer. So there's just a ton of fun associated with it. And I can't wait to see The Mandalorian on Disney, which is getting such big buzz. And Jon Favreau is a genius. So now I can't wait to see that. They do have their own DNA, and they are getting their own vibes. And meaning, you know, you kind of are deciding what show goes where. When we think about Netflix, we do think about how they're buying, what's performing, what's not. In Amazon, you know, we talk to them, and they want big shows. Amazon wants big difference, you know.
What does big mean to you, though? You know, just for the average listener, big to me, they're all big, but.
Well, Amazon particularly, you mentioned they're selling Prime memberships. I think Amazon is looking to whereas Netflix obviously wants big, but they're truly the first global service. They're in the most as a streamer, they're in the most territories. They want to appeal to a lot of different demographics. So not every show Netflix is doing needs to be The Crown or needs to be their big series. They're willing to do more niche nonfiction and cable shows like Fastest Car and shows like Nailed It, appealing to kind of different demographic niches like car lovers or food lovers and things like that. It seems to me like Amazon is going kind of Jack Ryan big. They're going they're looking to appeal to a big broad audience. They're not getting in the niches. And I think Hulu, it's kind of to be determined. You know, they're kind of really excelling at premium drama. You know, from The Handmaid's Tale, that was their kind of breakthrough. And subsequent to that, they're focusing on strong hour drama. And so they all are getting their own. And then Disney, we know that they have a very specific DNA. It's the Walt Disney Company. You know, they want to make people smile. They want to make people laugh. They want to create, a sense of awe. But they're not going to get into, you know, political topics, or they're not going to get into anything remotely kind of.
You're not going to have edgy stand-up sticky. Blasting out, you know, the president or something like that.
You're not going to have Bill Burr, the Bill Burr Comedy Hour, exactly on Disney. So that they are taking shape. They have their own. They have their own feels, and as a producer, we're cognizant to that. We feed into that. We watch it. It's such a great time to be a content supplier to these emerging, massive content. You know, these people who need so much content. So it's great. These companies.
To think about, we're closing in almost on the brief second, close to our second segment. However, there is so much innovation going on. There are those who want to You know, disrupt the disruptors. Quibi is a mobile-first short-form streaming video platform founded by former Disney and DreamWorks chief Jeffrey Katzenberg. That's set to launch next spring. Katzenberg explained his take on the viewing habits of Quibi's core audience, which is, he says, 25 to 30-year-olds.
Between 7 in the morning and 7 at night, right now, today, you're watching 70 Minutes, YouTube, Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook watching this. And that stuff's fantastic. We think we can bring Hollywood quality to that kind of consumption and bring a level of storytelling that the creators in that world had never been able to afford to do because they didn't have the resources. And in a subscription service, we actually can do it. And it's not dissimilar to what HBO did in the 1990s when they came along and said, we're not TV, we're HBO. And we would say to you, we're not short form, we're Quibi.
That from an interview Jeffrey Katzenberg gave to NBC's Dylan Byers. We're discussing the dawning of the second new era of streaming video, from disruptive innovators to all-out multi-front combat. We've got telecom companies like AT&T and Comcast, the Everything Store of Amazon, the world's leading consumer digital tech design company in Apple, the biggest players in Hollywood, a lot of them loading, buffering, and hoping to play. You can join our conversation. What, if anything, is keeping you from cutting the cord? I'm David Folkenflik, and you're listening to On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the rise of streaming services and the future of television. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me today, Sarah Fisher. She's media reporter for Axios. And Howard Owens. He's founder and co-CEO of Propagate, an independent production company. Want to take a couple of calls to help propel our conversation. One from Olathe, Kentucky. John, thanks for listening and thank you for calling in.
Yes, I just wanted to make a point. I live in a rural area, which not drastically rural by any means, but the only way we have any kind of service at all is through satellite, DirecTV, that type of thing. Internet connection is strictly through satellite, which is extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. So how are we supposed to take advantage of streaming services everybody seems to be going to? Do we get completely cut out of the loop and have no access to entertainment services whatsoever?
Mm-hmm. So let me throw that a little bit to you, Sarah Fisher. If John in Olathe is in a fairly rural area, he says not exceptionally so, and his only possible high-speed internet provider is through a satellite company, are they gouging him or are they charging him roughly the same kind of quasi-competitive rates that a cable provider would provide you if he was in Cincinnati or Lexington or somewhere else?
Well, regulators keep an eye on this because they want to make sure that, you know, people in rural areas of the country have access to equitable pay TV. And one of the things that they are concerned about is that as we do head into an era where there is TV that's migrating to streaming, which is obviously an internet marketplace, we don't have a really strong regulatory program in place to protect consumers there. And so there's a couple different things happening. One, you know, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, has been authorizing a lot of funding to increase rural broadband, to bring more competition to rural broadband so it's not just one or two providers that can come into a certain area and upcharge consumers who have no other choice. And then the other thing that they're trying to do, quite frankly, is just build out rural broadcast networks and build out some of the rural infrastructure for pay TV, but it's a tough thing. I mean, you take a look at a lot of these companies that are investing in the future of the internet. 5G, they're really looking at cities. They're not looking at rural parts of the country, in part because they think it's too expensive to build out there. And so this thing is that your listener called in about is critical. It's one of the biggest issues that we're talking about here in D.C. is how do we create equitable opportunity for people, for folks in rural America. And I will say I'm a little bit hopeful because I do know it's a big conversation that folks are having here.
Fascinating. I'd like to take a call also from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Sam, thanks for calling in.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, there are two basic reasons why I look to cutting the cable, obvious reasons. One would be to reduce costs while improving selection. But when you go for reducing costs, there's no way, because I could cancel my TV and my phone service from Verizon and go with nothing but an internet connection. And the next thing you know, I would be having to get voice over internet telephone, which is a pain in the butt. Plus, I'd have to put together this cacophony of companies that provide various, you know, video products. Now, yep. Presently, I've got Apple TV, so I've got Netflix, I've got Amazon Prime. For a while, I had YouTube TV, the part of YouTube that you pay for, and you get everything, including local channels on that. But it's basically just as expensive as the Verizon portion, the TV portion of my Verizon bill. So I just can't believe that there isn't a digital way to pay per show. All of this programming, all of this stuff that's out there in cyberspace has a digital tag to it. Why couldn't we, you know, at our end, you know, watch a show on Hulu and then switch over and watch a show on Amazon Prime and pay per show instead of, you know, having to be billed by multiple companies? Bruce Springsteen once sang a song called 57 Channels and Nothing On. Now I got literally 570 channels now, and they're still rarely find something I really want to watch. So just saying.
Thank you for calling in on that. You know, Howard Owen, obviously things that we had not dreamed of are available to us, and yet certain things stay the same. I remember in Washington covering it back in the days where it was like, well, senators are going to push a la carte pricing on cable providers so that you can't force consumers to take channels they didn't want. And, you know, there was a somewhat compelling case made pushed back by the television channel owners and by the cable providers that actually they'd have to raise rates on individual channels to make it profitable to the point where, you know, you'd end up getting kind of hosed regardless of which way you did it. Is there truth in what our caller just said, or is there something that would actually end up corroding and eroding the ability of production companies to actually create content that people might want?
Well, I certainly understand your caller's frustration. You know, sometimes it does feel like, well, I need to download this app now and I need to figure out, you know, sometimes when you're playing with your TV and trying to toggle from different, you know, streaming service to the other, it can be frustrating for anyone. There's a wish that it will become more seamless and that we will be able to go more simply from streaming service to streaming service. I think that, you know, that may be likely, but it does feel that these kind of fiefdoms, you know, from Amazon Prime to Hulu to Netflix to Disney to Apple to HBO Max and so forth are going to into Peacock. They're going to have their own kind of, I'll separate Peacock because that'll be ad supported, so that could be different. But they're going to have their own ecosystems, and they're going to try to get you to live there. They're going to try to give you, I think, as we grow, as many offerings as possible, at least several of them. And it doesn't feel like there's going to be a lot of swapping out, and people, you know. NBC Comcast just spent a ton of money on Peacock just spent a ton of money on The Office. They don't want that on Netflix anymore. They don't want the confusion of where to find The Office. So there is definitely more ownership, if you will, and it's going to be to find specific shows you need to be on specific services.
Right. HBO Max just reclaimed Friends, right? That was actually done through, Warner Brothers television
exactly.
studios. And they said, you know, Netflix, you've been riding that. You know, for all of the reasonable and rightly so attention that Netflix has gotten for the original productions they've done, Friends, my recollection was you know, the top show that they were getting, even to the extent that we had some understanding of what audience levels of, which of course these streaming services are incredibly careful to guard. Sarah Fisher, one question I have as a reporter as well as a consumer is that, you know, empires rise, empires also fall. So in recent years, we've seen this fight over CBS and Viacom, which was really were two halves of an empire split apart, the CBS side and a bunch of cable channels that seemed like they would be more profitable than mid part of the first decade of this century. That turned out CBS did very well under the now disgraced Les Moonves. They were put back together by Shari Redstone. So, you know, a much bigger, huge media conglomerate. And yet right now it looks tiny compared to all these enormous companies, these telecommunications companies, digital companies, whatever, that they're going to have to contend with. And, you know, although they do a little bit of streaming, they do some Star Trek streaming, they've got a nice little digital news streaming service. You know, it strikes me that even combined, CBS and Viacom would be very hard-pressed to compete with the owners of NBC and Time Warner and these other giants now that they're going to be doing streaming, basically be a platform as well as huge content generators. How does a place like that survive?
I don't think they're going to survive together standalone. I think Shari Redstone, who is the majority shareholder of both companies, she's the woman who's responsible for bringing them both together, recognizes that a company with a combined market cap of $30 billion is going to struggle up against a combined market cap at Apple of about, you know, $900 billion. And so I think her thought process is this is one step in building a giant scale company. And so what does that mean? Maybe she spins out the combined CBS Viacom to a company like Verizon that doesn't already own a broadcast network. And so from a regulatory perspective, they could own it. Maybe she tries to spin it out to a company like Amazon, again, does not already own a broadcast network, so they could buy it. I think Shari Redstone thinks this is the first step in a lot more consolidation for that company, because as you mentioned, even though these are big entertainment networks, these are not going to be able to compete at a money perspective with the big tech giants in Silicon Valley who by market cap, by value, are, you know, literally like 5 to 10 times their size.
You know, it is reminiscent of when the Murdoch family would wander around and say, "We've got scale," talking meaning that we are big enough to compete. And, you know, within a couple of years of that, sold most of their entertainment holdings off to Bob Iger and Disney. Howard Owens, do you see something, you know, I raised sort of teasingly the question about, you know, is having Martin Scorsese in a film that's got De Niro, Pacino, Pesci, and it's supposed to have some brilliant performances in there, but having a film like The Irishman clock in at 3.5 hours because, you know, that's how you get Scorsese, and also because Netflix can. There's no time limit. They don't have any particular edict. They're happy to make their talent happy and make a splash. Is that beneficial for the quality of what we see?
I mean, I think it is. I think there's no denying the quality of filmed entertainment and content is at an all-time peak. You know, you can argue that there's too many channels and not enough on. But if you're if you love content and are looking to for dramas and comedies and nonfiction and documentary, there is no better time. I think if Martin Scorsese wants to make a 3.5 hour film and Netflix wants to fund it and give him the platform to distribute it, then the viewers will tell. They'll know. Netflix will see. Are they going to make another Scorsese film? Because that'll tell you. I mean, Netflix kind of seems to put their money where their mouth is, and if you deliver, they back up the truck. So we'll see. But I certainly think the times that we're living in, it's undeniable that the quality of content is the result of this massive investment that Sarah's been talking about.
And when you talk about quality of content, you're saying even though that there's been an incredible dramatic growth in outlets and in hours in each of these outlets in terms of what's available, no longer inhibited by how many hours there are in a day, right? You're saying even with all that expansion, both of players in the field, but also of the number of hours that they can that they have bandwidth for, literal bandwidth for, that there has been an accompanying increase in quality. You think it's basically all boats are rising at the same time?
I'm not saying that everything that's going on air is quality. I'm saying, of course, they have a lot of there are a lot of pipes to fill, and so there's always going to be a difference in quality. I'm saying, at the top end, I think that we are in an incredible boom time for quality content, and then just from a creative license, because creators no longer need to create based on act breaks, based on six acts in an hour and based on timing. It no longer has to be a half hour, an hour, because the creative can drive the form as opposed to the form driving the creative output. There is much more creative liberation, and I don't think you'd see these billions and billions and billions of dollars of investment moving forward if there wasn't a belief that this kind of new streaming ability has unlocked creative freedom that's resulting in big wins creatively.
House of Cards was Netflix's first significant hit involving an original series. Well, I use the term original a little loosely. It was the American transplant of a brilliant British series. That was back in 2013. Ted Sarandos is Netflix's chief content officer. He expressed surprise at the amount of time it took for competitors to create their own original programming. He spoke in October at Vanity Fair's New Establishment Summit. Here he was interviewed by Katie Couric.
When we made this bet, we bet this was going to be an enormous space, and we wouldn't be the only ones.
Are you surprised it took this long, by the way?
Completely. I was surprised it took everyone so long to get in. When they were selling us their content years ago, I was kind of surprised every time. And because if we were drinking our own Kool-Aid, if we were believing this story, then all these networks were going to become apps and network and dot-coms, and that they would want their content. In the meantime, they sold it to us and helped us build a big audience. But this is why we made House of Cards 7 years ago. I said, someday these guys are not going to sell us their programming, and we better get good at it. And that was our first original investment in 7 years ago.
Sarah Fisher, I'm going to let you take us out of that. Ted Sarandos there articulating a little bit of what Howard Owens was getting at about the question of who owns the programming and the need to do it. Netflix obviously devoting billions to original content and to trying to hold on to content. At the same time, Netflix is facing bigger companies, Apple, Amazon, biggest companies among the biggest companies in the world. Is Netflix itself the original disruptor in some ways likely to be disrupted?
Yeah, I absolutely think that's the case. And I was there when Ted Sarandos gave that talk to Katie Couric. Uh-huh. I think what happened was that Netflix was able to capture this programming on the cheap from these networks. This Ted Sarandos sounds surprised, because why would you give away your precious IP, your intellectual property, for so cheap? But at the time, these TV networks just kind of saw it as added value. Remember, Netflix wasn't huge from a streaming services subscriber perspective, so no network thought it was really worth all that much to give their programming to Netflix. Netflix very wisely was able to use it to cultivate an audience. And once it grew massive, and once it started to replace the eyeballs that were coming to these networks on regular TV, I think that's when the TV network said, oh my God, we got to get our content back, or else Netflix is going to eat us alive. And so this concept of them taking all of their own shows off of Netflix, putting it on their own networks and their own streaming services, as Howard mentioned, things like The Office, things like Friends.
So that's a threat to Netflix then?
Huge threat to Netflix.
Okay. We're going to leave that as the final word. Sarah Fisher, media reporter for Axios. So great to have your insight today.
Thank you.
And we're appreciative to Howard Owens. He's founder and co-CEO of Propagate, an independent entertainment production company that's created programming for Netflix, Amazon, Apple, and many others. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, David and Sarah.
You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. Our show On Point, it's produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Jeffrey Lyne, Wes Martin, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point.